happened? What happened?
You got shot.
What's your name? Wake up. What's your name?
Shit.
If there ever was a time, it would be now. That's all I'm saying. If there ever was a time to get on your feet, take it to the street. Cause you're the one that's getting played right now by the game they're playing. Come on, meet me down at the Cardi Park and say, oh, where are
the Hi, this is Cindy Sheehan, and you're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. You're listening at either Community Progressive Radio or CindySheehanSoapbox.com. Our guest today is Dr. Jill Stein. Jill is a mother, housewife, physician, longtime teacher of internal medicine, and pioneering environmental health advocate. Jill was born in Chicago and raised in suburban Highland Park, Illinois. She graduated magna cum laude from Harvard College in 1973 and from Harvard Medical School in 1979. Jill enjoys writing and performing music and enjoys long walks with her Great Dane, Bandita. Dr. Stein lives in Lexington with her husband, Richard Rohr, also a physician. She has two sons, Ben and Noah, who have graduated from college in the past few years. Jill is seeking the nomination of the Green Party for the President of the United States. She has a wonderful and extensive resume at her website, jillstein.org. Jill, welcome to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox.
It's great to be with you, Cindy.
And it's nice to be talking to you again. I know we met each other sometime back in Boston. We did an event together. And, at that time I was impressed with your, how articulate you are, how intelligent you are, what a great grasp of the issues you have. And so my first question is going to be, how's your campaign going so far?
Well, first, just right back at you, I was just so delighted to see what you're like in person, as though your reputation wasn't, stature enough. You were like a giant even compared to your reputation. So,
well, I guess it depends on who you listen to.
I guess so. But I only listen to the right people, you can be sure.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so the campaign is really, it's going awesome, wonderful. It's been such a surprise that it is what it is. You know, I had expected this to be really rough going and kind of bitter and, how dare you kind of terrain, but it hasn't been that at all. It's been like handing out, candy for Christmas or Kwanzaa or Hanukkah or whatever you like. It's been really wonderful. And people seem, to be at this breaking point that's really very exciting. And I've never had such an open and exciting conversation. I've run for office many times before, and it has never been like this.
Who were you expecting bitterness from?
I guess I was expecting pushback from kind of the establishment politics, the machine, which has always made itself, very much felt in my previous campaigns. I thought that this would be much more difficult and much more of an uphill battle, but in fact it's exactly the opposite because, as independent political peace, justice advocates, we've sort of been, kind of ahead of the curve of the mainstream, but the mainstream is kind of catching up to us with a vengeance right now to say that, wow, you guys are really right, that we really are being shafted by the system, and there's incredible hunger out there now for, for a politics of integrity, a politics that people can trust, politics that expresses this incredible movement for democracy and justice and peace that is alive and cooking out there at the grassroots and has typically been very, denied by establishment politics. And people have kind of had it up to here with that now and are really hungering for something different. So I find the challenge really is not to so much to persuade people as to just let them know that we're here, the students who are struggling with, just devastating levels of debt essentially, you know, functioning as indentured servants. The people, you know, the huge majority now that wants out of Afghanistan, that's had enough with our policies of, you know, of empire and expansion. You know, people who want health care and aren't getting it, you know, even with the Romney Care or Obamacare, whatever you call it. We have it in Massachusetts, and it really doesn't make much difference, to tell you the truth. You know, so people are really waking up. You know, the bailouts, which have just proceeded, you know, on steroids under Obama, as if, you know, he was going to be a solution to that, and the attack on immigrant rights, which has been much worse under this president than before. So it's like the illusion that Obama and the Democrats were going to solve this problem of corporate corrupted politics. You know, that illusion has really bitten the dust, and there's not a sign out there that there's hope on the horizon within the corporate political system. So it's such an exciting wake-up call now. The challenge is, you know, to get the word out.
Well, how much, first of all, just a couple comments that you made, you know, on what you just said. So you were talking about the people who want to blame Ralph Nader for 2000, for George Bush winning 2000, that you would expect pushback from those kind of people.
Exactly. That's right. And it's I can't say it's not there at all, but it has really been, what shall we say, it's had a big wake-up call, and people get now that, that silence, you know, they might have argued it 10 years ago, so progressives, unfortunately, so-called progressives, you know, have been duped and, you know, have been good little foot soldiers and have been muzzling themselves. And people now are sort of waking up that silence is not an effective political strategy. And this politics of fear has basically delivered everything that we were afraid of. You know, we've got it in spades, the expanding wars, the meltdown of the climate, the incredible disparities of in the economy and the endless Wall Street bailouts, you know. So politics of fear gives you everything you're afraid of. It's not the solution. So all those anti-Naderites, you know, all those kind of spoiler mongers, you know, have really had a big wake-up call. So I'm not hearing from them. It's really shocking.
Do you and your campaign advisors, do you think some of that might pick up after the nominating conventions, when it's getting down to the nitty-gritty, when people start telling us if we vote for you, we'll be wasting our vote, and if we vote for you, we may elect, you know, I call them Bar Mitt Obamny, you know, because I really see very little difference between the two. So do you think a little bit of that's going to pick up? Are you ready for that?
Absolutely. And in fact, we try to put it on the table and address it right up front. You know, I sort of feel like this campaign has everything to do with political therapy, you know, because people are in such a state of shock for whatever reason. You know, we've got this kind of shock political culture now, this shock and awe, I guess you'd say, political culture. And I find it so important to be able to talk through this fear that has been drummed into people. But you know, it's like the lower you get in the age spectrum, the more like they're completely like in disbelief that people even believe such a thing, you know, because it's the students who are really, and the younger generation in general that's just taking it on the chin. They're the ones who have the highest unemployment and are carrying around these outrageous student loans and have been just brutalized with, you know, high-stakes testing and teaching to the test, and they are inheriting the climate crisis and the jobs crisis and all that. So it's like they don't get it. You know, they don't get what this spoiler thing is about. As far as they're concerned, it's their lives that are being spoiled. It's not somebody's political career.
And like you said, you've run for office before, and as have I. I ran in 2008. Do you think that it's a little more welcoming, third party or independent, because, like you said, the young people are not understanding about the spoiler, and they're understanding that you know, the politics as usual is basically ruining not just our country but the earth. Do you think that Occupy has something to do with the Occupy movement, has something to do with a more welcoming climate for third party politics?
Absolutely, and I think we can't thank Occupy enough for really breaking the sound barrier and sort of breaking the stranglehold of the corporate political parties and the corporate media on political dialogue. They've managed to break through, and this is a wonderful thing. You know? And so they're not simply, you know, marching to the beat of the corporate drum, and they rightly have their guard up against predatory politics. Often the challenge is to reassure them that there is another kind of politics which is not predatory, which serves them, and in fact historically, which has been really critical, that independent third political parties have been really important in the history of social progress, that every time there was a really powerful social movement, or not every time, but most of the time, there were powerful social movements working in alliance with independent political parties. So the movement for women's right to vote had the Women's Party, and the abolition of slavery had the Liberty Party, and the right to unionize, and for the 40-hour work week, and minimum wage, and Social Security, and the New Deal, and all that, you know, safe workplaces, that had the socialist and the progressive and the labor parties, that political parties have helped. At the end of the day, it's the movement in the street, you know, which is the real engine, but political parties help articulate the agenda and the demand, which Frederick Douglass, you know, famously said that power concedes nothing without the demand, never has, never will. And independent political parties can bring that demand in and help get it into the public dialogue. So, yes, you know, infinite gratitude to Occupy. And, you know, I think it's an ongoing conversation to show them that we are not, you know, the same beast. We don't take the corporate contributions. We are of, by, and for the people, and working in alliance, and can really help leverage and synergize with their power in the street and bring that message to drive it forward into the broader political agenda.
Well, how is I know that in the primaries, you've won, I think, 11 primaries for the Green Party nomination. How is that going within the party? Are you pretty confident that you will get the Green Party nomination?
I think it's looking that way. We've won every single one. I think it's 11, it might be 12 of the primaries and conventions and caucuses so far. And you know, at the end of the day, I think the party values a track record and experience. There are other, you know, very good candidates that are in the game, and I think it's wonderful to have a contested primary. And I'm very grateful to Roseanne Barr for just stepping up, as many people of, shall we say, you know, great wealth and resources, you know, don't have the conviction and the courage to do. I think she has a lot of courage and strength to, you know, have taken it upon herself to enter the political fray, and it's a wonderful thing, and I think we're all richer for it. At the end of the day, I think the party really values a track record, because as you know, having run for office yourself, it's just not intuitive. You really need a team of people who've done it before and who know how to play the game and who have a set of resources and all that. You know, I hadn't intended to run, and I got recruited to run, and basically I agreed to do it because an amazing team of people came out from all across the states, you know, from California to New York, all across the country. There was just a whole swath of very experienced and committed people who felt like I did, and I'm sure you do too, that we just cannot, it's just unconscionable to let what's happening go down without publicly challenging it and helping to build the movement, which is alive and well in the street. It needs a voice in the dialogue, and it needs a choice in the polls in November. And I think all bets are off on what will happen. Who would have expected, Tunisia and Egypt to have overthrown entrenched dictators by the sheer power of really the conviction of young people who saw no future for themselves? And many of those same things on the landscape are exactly the same here as they are in Egypt and Tunisia, where you've got a bunch of educated young people who have no future, have a very high unemployment rate, and are just being treated like a cash cow for banks to exploit with these draconian loans, and frankly for political parties to exploit and make mincemeat out of on behalf of the 1%, because it's young people who are not only supporting tax breaks for the wealthy with the high tuition rates that they've had to have inflicted on them. That's essentially to support these tax breaks that our politicians have provided. And at the same time now, young people, they're also taking it on the chin, supporting the profits of Wall Street banks, because that's who it is that administers these loans. And the administration costs are horrendous. So, yeah, I mean, on all counts, I think it's, there are people who are really fighting angry right now and ready to stand up, so it could be a very exciting couple months coming up.
I watch a lot of cable news because I figure I watch the news so I can know, essentially what not to believe. And what they're paying attention to the most is what I shouldn't, and there must be another, something really important that they're not reporting on. But I was watching the two candidates for the corporate parties, Barmit, Obamny, and all day on the corporate media, they were talking about, student loans. That's the big wedge issue now.
Yeah.
Is student loans, or is Congress going to allow the interest rate to double? But without talking about what the real problem is, the real problem is education should not be so expensive and hard to access for people of the working class and the people of the poor class. And our children shouldn't have to go into lifelong debt, no matter what the interest rate is, because they want to avail themselves of the human right of education. And I posted something about that on my Facebook. Then, of course, I got into a status update, got into a big debate with some of the propertarians that I like to call libertarians. And, but then your campaign, and I'm on your campaign list, and I would encourage all of my listeners to do the same, and I'll give you a chance to say what your website is, but you said to forgive student loans.
Exactly.
And what do we do after we forgive student loans? Because, of course, I believe the same thing, but what do we do about the high cost of higher education in this country?
Oh, exactly. I mean, forgiving student loans is step one, and concurrent with that, step two is making public higher education free, because as you say, it is a human right. It's also essential for economic security, and in the same way that a high school degree was essential for security in the 20th century, and we paid for that, a college degree is essential for economic security in the 21st century. So, by logical extension, it too should be covered as a public good. And, we know that it is enormous public good. Just to look, for example, at the GI Bill, where we put something like 14 million, 16 million, something like that, returning soldiers from World War II to college. And the numbers on that show that for every dollar invested by the taxpayers, essentially $7 was $7 was returned in terms of greater productivity in the economy and revenues returned to the Treasury. So there's no doubt that this is a no-brainer, good, and essential thing to do. The cost of doing it is somewhere, it's estimated to be somewhere between $15 to $30 billion a year, which, mm-hmm. that's a wow. cost, but hello, you know, that's, I mean, what did we come up with for the banks, you know, $16 trillion, and it's $1 trillion a year for this bloated military-industrial security complex, you know, so our answer to that is, basically, when they say there's not enough money, what they really mean is there's not enough money for you, because there's plenty of money for, basically, trillions in Wall Street bailouts, wars for oil, tax breaks for the wealthy, and the ginormous waste of dollars, tax dollars and personal dollars in the massive private health insurance bureaucracy, and just moving to a Medicare for all single payer system essentially frees up trillions of dollars over the next decade, not only because of averted bureaucratic wasteful costs, but also medical inflation goes away when you have a single-payer Medicare mm-hmm. for all system. So, you know, there are win-wins out there. There's no doubt that we can do it. And, in fact, we know also that there's enormous public support for every one of these proposals. So it keeps coming down to the hurdle is, you know, it's like getting the word out among ourselves and daring to stand up for ourselves, for those who are still locked in the fear closet, you know. That's the key hurdle, is recognizing that it's nowhere but down, you know, within politics as usual, and it's nowhere but up, you know, getting outside of the box with true people-powered progressive non-corporate political campaign like what we're offering in this presidential race.
When it's really hard to pin down how much the U.S. spends on the military, because there's the Pentagon budget, and then there's the wars, and there's Black Ops, and there's all kinds of different aspects to it. But I tried to figure it out one time. I did a very basic math on this, and I figured out for every $1 the federal government spends on education, they spend about $70 on the military. And that's just like a really basic kind of thing that I did. You know, Jill, I think the problem in the United States, you know, with what, for better lack of a better word, the 99%, I call them the Roth class, the robber class, and the Roth class, not the 1%, not the 99%. And when I met you, I was talking about my book, Miss America. But I think the problem is that people in the United States, even the people in the Roth class, have a real hard time accepting the fact that some things are basic human rights, like education, like health care, like access to housing and healthy food and clean air and clean water. Those are basic human rights that are recognized as such in many countries around the world. Mm-hmm. What in the United States, even we in the 99%, you know, I'm saying in general, think that these are privileges. And I think that the best thing we can do is convince everybody that we have a right to these things, and as the rich get richer, they're basically inhibiting or prohibiting our access to our basic human rights. And that's something that I think your campaign, when you come out and call for forgiveness of all student loans, is a very important, a very important alternative to the corporate parties.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, FDR himself had a bill of economic rights, or, you know, and human rights, and to say that the right to decent housing, to education, to retirement security, to health care. FDR, you know, put that on the record, and a lot of people sure agreed with him. And Martin Luther King echoed that. You know, the United Nations took it up. And as you say, there are lots of countries around the world that accept that. Right now, you know, in this country, there are clearly some, I'd say many issues where poll after poll shows that a vast majority of people get it. There are very vocal and empowered minorities, you know, basically on the payroll of the 1%, you know, that are out to push back against that and to try to, you know, bury it and talk you out of it. But most people really do accept that we have a right to, you know, to decent wages, to a more equitable economy, to decent housing, health care as a human right, taxing the rich and a fair taxation system, to bringing the troops home and putting our dollars into strengthening our communities instead of destroying others, you know, outside of our borders. So there's, I think there's a lot of wiggle room here, and that by focusing first on those areas where there's already really broad agreement, we can make huge progress forward. And clearly, a very important step along the way is democratizing our communication system and our political system so that we can harness the power of public opinion, which currently our political system is, you know, very carefully concocted now so that it will not harness the power of everyday people. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's plenty for us, you know, that where we have a quorum, an overwhelming quorum of public opinion, or shall I say, you know, at least critical mass of public opinion to move a lot of legislation. And the key is getting ourselves elected in various key positions. And one pitch I want to make for why the presidential race is really important, you know, even if you don't have a Congress behind you, and the Congress is still, say, it's corrupt Democratic Republican self, although there will be many third parties. I don't know what Peace and Freedom is doing, but I know that the Greens are running many congressional candidates. I'd say I've probably met 20 or 30 of them so far, just, you know, going around the country. So there will be options to put good people into Congress and other, you know, more local offices as well, in addition to the presidency. But in my view, you know, the president should not simply be the so-called commander-in-chief, but rather the organizer-in-chief. That's something that Obama absolutely could have done, and he, you know, absolutely declined to do that. You know, there were a lot of people that were ready to go to work, and that's what we would be doing. You know, if we are so lucky as to turn the White House into a greenhouse, which ought to happen, let's make it a nurturing and healthful place, but we would have no trouble. You know, the trouble is getting elected. But once you're elected, you have so much power of bully pulpit and public communications and, you know, running a liberated moveon.org, as in move on from the Democratic Party already, you know. But you can do that kind of orchestrated campaign each time a bill is coming up. So it's like, hey, folks, a Medicare for All bill is going to be voted on next week. This is the time to call your congresswomen and men and senators and give them these three reasons for why they need to vote for it. And the bottom line is, if they want your vote in November, they sure as hell better give you their vote right now for a health care system that actually supports life and a decent economy. You know, so that right now, as a democracy, well, we don't have a democracy, obviously. You know, people are flying blind. We don't have a press. We have an oppress and a depress, you know, and any executive, whether it's president or governor or mayor, can essentially be a, a communications coordinator, you know, to make sure people know what's coming up, when it's coming up, and to put voters and ordinary residents of the community in charge of what passes and what doesn't, because we pull the curtain up on what goes on in the halls of power. Right now, that curtain is totally down, and it's firewalled, and we don't have public records and open meeting laws and a responsible press. But, you know, we're at a breaking point. Let's make that breaking point a tipping point, you know, and take back our democracy. And one way we can do that is by electing a president that actually could get our democracy in gear again and begin to implement these solutions that people are begging for.
Well, Dr. Jill Stein, we are out of time, and I would like you to tell my listeners how they can help you, because I know you still have many obstacles, matching funds, obstacles, getting on the ballot. So how can my listeners help you overcome those obstacles? Because campaigning, it takes a lot of people, not just the candidate, to be out there doing the hard work.
That's so true, and we have an opportunity, I think, like none we've had, certainly in my lifetime, to really, to really change our direction. And, you know, if people just go to jillstein.org, and that's Jill, S-T-E-I-N, as one word, .org, and join the team. And if you, sign up as a volunteer, you'll get the newsletter, you can just forward it, and then, you know, that becomes a way to share the good news and the empowerment and just the exciting possibilities with your network, and for all of us to power each other up. You can make a contribution if you can. That you'll be doubling your money. We're very close to getting federal matching funds, and every dollar that comes in will be doubled once we are at the threshold, and we have to meet that in a few more states. So wherever you are, if you can make a contribution, anything up to $250 gets matched dollar for dollar. You can contribute at the website. You can help out in the ballot drive, and you can just sign up on the website to do that. And the main thing is just get the word out. Let's go viral, because this is, you know, this is the time to change that breaking point into a tipping point, and let's take back the promise of democracy and the peaceful, just, green future that really is within our reach if we stand up and insist on it. We have the numbers, and whether we get to 52% or 2%, it's all a win for simply regaining our political voice and our political momentum, and having a base from which we build and a base from which we drive these real solutions into the political dialogue. It's a win no matter how you cut it if you're a part of it.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for taking some time to be on the show, and we hope that it'll bring some interest to your campaign, and I wish you and the Soapbox wishes you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, Cindy, and just highest gratitude to you for all your incredible, inspired leadership and inspiration all the way. So keep it up. Thank you so much.
Okay, talk to you soon. Take care of yourself.
Take care. You too.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. See you on the trail. Bye-bye.
What happened? What happened?
She got shot.
What's your name? Wake up. What's your name?
Shit.
If there ever was a time, it would be now. That's all I'm saying.
Well, that was our show for today. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, I'd like to thank my engineer, Scott Cuddy, my webmaster, Richard Bowser, my producer, Mikey, our guest, Dr. Jill Stein, and we wish her the best of luck, especially you for listening and for supporting the show. This is Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Peace out for now.
Get down. Where are the youth? We need you now. If there ever was a time, it would be now to make the masters see this. If there ever was a time to get downtown and get right now, it's a party park. And News Corp says you don't have a plan. Well, sit down, man. I'll tell you again. The plan's to stand together up to green. And a tear gas can in a veteran's face won't change the case.